You're listening to the New Community Podcast of Palm Valley Church. We hope that this message encourages you in your walk with Christ.
Good evening. Well, over the past several weeks, we have been in a series called Shema, and we've been looking at a passage of scripture found in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And we talked about the different nuances of each of the heart and the soul, but tonight I want to take the third one and talk about strength. I know for me, the word strength elicits a certain visual, right? When I think of strength, I think of somebody really strong, somebody that can move big, heavy things, somebody that looks something like me. I don't know what's funny, but we'll go with it. In our 21st century English-speaking mind, I think we all are on the same page about what strength means, but I don't know that a first century Jewish person would have had quite the same picture. And so right out of the gate tonight, I want to take a look at what this word specifically means in its original context and its original language. And rather than me trying to do what only an expert could do such a great job, I figured I'd let the experts do it over at Bible Project. So let's take a look at the screens and check this out.
For thousands of years, every morning and evening, Jewish people have prayed these well-known words as a way of expressing their devotion to God. They're called the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And as for you, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your strength. We're going to look at the last word, strength. The Hebrew word is ma'od, and it occurs some 300 times in the scriptures, and it doesn't actually mean strength. There is a perfectly good word for strength in Hebrew, and ma'od is not it. In fact, the Shema is one of the only places in the whole Bible where ma'od is translated as strength. So, what's up with that? The most common meaning of ma'od is very or much. It's what grammar nerds call an adverb, a word that comes alongside other words to augment their meaning. For example, in Genesis chapter 1, God looks at the world that he's made, and six times he calls it good. But then the climactic seventh time, he says it is ma'od good. That is, very good. Later in Genesis, in the story of Noah, the floodwaters keep rising and they become ma'od powerful, or extremely powerful over the land. In the story of Cain and Abel, Cain wasn't just angry at his brother, he was ma'od angry. Or when Saul became the king of Israel, he was ma'od happy. So you can see why ma'od occurs hundreds of times in the Bible. It's a really common Hebrew word that intensifies the meaning of other words. Very this, or really that. However, biblical authors could use ma'od in ways that are unique. Like when they want to increase a word's force to total capacity, they'll say ma'od twice. So Jacob became ma'od, ma'od wealthy with flocks and camels and donkeys and servants. Or the Israelite spies went to investigate the promised land and they say, the land we pass through is ma'od, ma'od good. So it's pretty clear, ma'od doesn't mean strength in terms of muscle power, but rather very or much. So let's come back to the Shema, where people are called to love God with all of their heart, that is their will and affections, and with all of their soul, that is their whole life and physical being, and with all of their ma'od, that is with all of their muchness. And while that sounds kind of funny, you also kind of get it. If ma'od can intensify any word's meaning to total capacity, then this final thing that you use to love God isn't a thing at all. It's actually everything. Loving God with your ma'od means devoting every possibility, opportunity, and capacity that you have to honoring God and loving your neighbor as yourself. It's the most wide and expansive word in the Shema. Ma'od can refer to almost anything. Which raises one last and really fascinating point. Because this word was capable of many nuances of meaning, ancient Jewish communities interpreted ma'od in the Shema in different ways. So the ancient Jewish scholars who translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, when they came to ma'od in the Shema, they translated it with the Greek word dunamis, that is, power or strength. This is the interpretation adopted by most modern translations. But if you look at the ancient Aramaic translations of the Hebrew Bible, you'll discover that these scholars interpreted ma'od to mean wealth. Money is a concrete thing that opens up all kinds of opportunities to love God by giving away resources. And when Jesus was asked about the most important command in Scripture, he quoted the Shema, and he used two words to unpack the meaning of ma'od. He said, "Love God with all of your mind and with all of your power." Both are human capacities that can be used to love God in an infinite number of ways. So, which of these interpretations of ma'od is right? Does it mean strength or wealth or mind? That's the wrong question. The word ma'od doesn't limit the number of ways you can show love for God, just the opposite. The point is that everything in a person's life, every moment and every opportunity, every ability and capacity offers a chance to love and honor the one who made you. It's a call to love God with all of your muchness. And that's the meaning of strength in the Shema.
Well, what a ma'od video, right? In order to kind of unpack this, I think we need to go back and talk a little bit about God's people. Walk through their story and see how God has illustrated this throughout their story. If we look at the people of Israel, God's chosen vessel for salvation to the world, they've come out of years of slavery in Egypt, and they're immediately thrust into a dire situation, into a difficult time. Now, up until this point, their life in Egypt had been one of suffering, one that was not enviable by anybody. They'd been mistreated, they'd been exploited, and in fact, they had had the impossible asked of them. Lest we forget, in Exodus chapter 5, verses 7 to 9, it says, "You are no longer to supply the people," this is Pharaoh talking, "with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. This is why they're crying out. Let us go and sacrifice to our God. Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." They're oppressed. They're in bondage. They're in a place that is not good, right? And so they begin to cry out to God, "God, save us. Save us from this people. Save us and take us out of here. Take us to the place where we're supposed to be." And God hears their cry. He raises up a man named Moses. And he says, "Go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go." So he does. Several times, in fact. And each time, Pharaoh says, "Nah, not going to happen. Not going to happen." And what does God do? God displays his power. He displays his might. He displays his majesty through the 10 plagues, and he says, "Look, I'm showing you what's up. I'm showing you who I really am, and you should probably listen, Pharaoh." But 10 times, he says, "No, I'm not going to let him go." Until the 10th, when each of the firstborn in all the land, except for those who had the blood of a slain lamb painted on their doorpost, is taken. Pharaoh finally says, he relents, "Let him go. Let him go." God has displayed his power time and again, but he's not done. The people, they leave Egypt and they head out. We presume to the promised land, but in order to do that, they've got to go through the desert. And in order to get to the desert, they've got to cross a big body of water. Now, many scholars believe that this group of people could be as much as 4 million people, as few as 600,000. I don't know that in these types of numbers it really matters. It was a lot of people, right? And so there's not a rowboat in this time that takes them across this body of water, right? And so God shows up. He parts the waters before them, and not only parts the waters, he sends them across on dry ground. They cross the Red Sea. And not only that, as Pharaoh begins to chase them down, to bring them back to Egypt, because this guy just doesn't learn, the waters collapse on him and his army, once again saving God's people from certain death. It's amazing. And they go to the other side of the Red Sea, and you think, man, I don't know if this were me, and I'm looking back, on a time like this, I don't know that I would need much more convincing that this is the God I need to follow, that this is the way I need to go. To see a God who had taken care of things in Egypt, to see a God who had taken care of things in the Red Sea, who has shown up time and again in powerful, moving ways. I don't know how much more convincing I need, but God sends them into the desert. And he sends them into the desert to test them. And they go in for three tests. And it's easy to look at that and say, but why did they need testing? Like, wasn't that enough? Wasn't it enough? Like, they probably would believe you after that, right? But I think God knew something that we didn't. And we have the benefit now, hundreds, thousands of years later, of seeing the whole picture. And later on in Deuteronomy, Moses gives us some insight into why God chose to test his people. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, he says, Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothes did not wear out. Your feet did not swell during these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord your God disciplines you. You see, God sent his people into the desert to test them, to see what they were made of, to see how they were going to obey him, to see it's not just about what I've done for you, it's about how you respond to what I've done for you. And I love that last line. In your heart, know then in your heart, as a man disciplines his son, so the Lord disciplines you. So 3 days, 3 days into their journey into the wilderness, they come to a place called Marah. Marah. They come to a place in the desert, and I don't know if you've been in a desert, but it's hot. Well, we've all kind of been in the desert, Rio Grande Valley. It's hot, we get it, right? It's hot. 3 days, this is three, am I emphasizing enough? 3 days, okay? 1, 2, 3, we got it. 3 days they go into the desert, and I'm presuming at this point they probably have run out of water. And they're thirsty. Stands to reason. They're thirsty. They get to this place called Marah, and there's no water. And in fact, the only water that's there, it's undrinkable. The scripture says it's bitter. It's bitter water. We can't do anything with this water. And the people are mad. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a place in your life where you've gone several days without water. I have not. But there was a time many years ago when I was working construction where I was doing a job way off in the country, and it was, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes from the nearest town, from the nearest convenience of modern day. And so I probably should have taken water with me. I probably should have taken, you know, whatever food I needed for that day. But, you know, I was in a hurry that morning. I don't know if I woke up late. I don't really remember what happened, but I got to the site and I didn't have any water. And it was 110 degrees that day. And I remember thinking, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. I can make it through today. No big deal. I'll go through the whole day. I'll work. I'll get to the end of the day. I'll get home. I'll get some water then, right? It's not going to be a problem. So I start working, and sure enough, everything's fine. For a while, everything's good for a few hours, but then you start to get that feeling. No, I'm okay. Shake it off, get back to work, it's all right. A couple hours later, it's like this nagging feeling in the back of my head that's just like, you are thirsty. You are so thirsty, right? And it just won't leave me alone. Then the headache starts, and then the spots come. Then this number, right? The woof. And I began to discern that something was amiss. Now I was young and stupid, so I worked for another few minutes until finally things got real hazy, and I was like, you know, I gotta drive myself somewhere because I'm absolutely not asking somebody to take me. So I get in my vehicle, and I head into town, and we're still 30 to 40 minutes from the nearest water, and I just remember the only goal I had was water. The only goal I had was getting to that place of refreshment, of sustenance, to getting to that place where I was going to be okay. And all I thought about was that moment where I grabbed that bottle of water. And I remember walking into that gas station, going to the coolers, and finding the largest bottle of water possible. I didn't even go to the front. I grabbed it, I opened it, and I went to town on that thing. And I had, I think it was like a liter and a half. I don't know, it was this big thing. And I had that thing done in about 45 seconds. And I remember the clerk just kind of looking at me like, are you okay, sir? I am now. This wasn't even a whole day. I'd been without water for maybe 8 hours. Now, granted, it was hot, but so was the desert. And it's easy for us to look at Scripture, to read this story of these people and say, come on, but God just did all those things for you. He just did the plagues, and he took you out of slavery. He crossed you on dry ground. Dry ground! What's wrong with you? But they're thirsty. And they probably should be at this point. Imagine being an Israelite, walking through the desert. It's hot. It's hot. And then it's more hot. And then the water starts to run out. And you start to get that feeling of desperation. And then the next day comes and it's getting desperate, and you're looking to the left and saying, "Hey, I don't know. I don't know how much more I can take of this. I don't." And you're getting desperate for water. And even though God had done all of this that moment, they still had a need, and they were thirsty. So God, he says to Moses, "Take this stick. I don't know why a stick, but a stick. Take this stick, throw it in the water, and it'll be okay." He takes the stick, he throws it in the water, and lo and behold, the water becomes drinkable, and their thirst is satisfied. They travel on for several weeks, and then a new need arises, and they begin to grumble and complain once again. They look at Moses, and they say, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt." Like, real drama right now. There we sat around pots of meat. We ate all the food we wanted, but you brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly. But you brought us here, Moses. You did this. Isn't it funny how in moments of frustration in our lives, we get to a point when back there starts to look really sweet. Whatever your back there is, I don't know, but what I know about back there is oftentimes back there, all we ever did was complain. All it ever was a difficult situation. But when you're in the midst of strife, back there starts to look pretty good. Back there starts to say, I don't know about this, but back there at least we had food, not mentioning the exploitation, the oppression that they experienced. But back there, well, we had food. We had pots of meat. There was water. But you brought us out of there. So once again, they ask God, "Give us food." And God provides. He rains down manna from heaven, bread, quail for meat in the evenings. He gives them exactly what they've asked for. He provided for their exact need. If we skip ahead to the New Testament, We see an interaction with Jesus where he's around his disciples and people are wondering and asking, well, who are you? And he makes an explanation here in John chapter 6 and 7. I just want to read it. It says this in verse 32. Very truly, I tell you, it is not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is the bread that comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Then Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry again. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty again. Later in chapter 7, it says, on the last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood, said in a loud voice, let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within. For the people of Israel, God provides for their physical need multiple times. In the testing, he provides for them, but in Jesus, we have every need we could ever want. All of our spiritual needs, not just physical, but our spiritual, our emotional, our relational needs, they're found in him, the true source, the true bread of life. Moses' bread was great, he says, but I am the bread of life. I have living water. This water, you'll thirst again. My water, that's it. That's all you need. More on that in a minute. There's a third test that happens. They come out of Egypt. They go into the desert. They need water. God gives them water. They need food. God gives them food. Then they need water again. They come to a place called Rephidim. And once again, these daggum Israelites, they're thirsty. What's wrong with them? It's hot, guys. I mean, it's hot. Let's let them off the hook a little bit. You know, just in light of speaking tonight, yesterday I did a little experiment on myself. Don't judge me. I went most of the day without drinking water. I know. If there's doctors in here, I'm sorry. My wife's a nurse, and the answer to everything is drink water. I'm serious. My arm hurts. Did you drink water? What's that got to do with anything? So everything apparently. It's spiritual. I went most of the day without drinking water just to have in my mind for tonight that idea of thirst, right? And I'm not gonna condone this, but you should definitely try it. Just to remind myself, where were they at to a greater degree? Where were they at? What were they thinking? Okay, I'm letting them off the hook a lot tonight, guys, because I think it's really easy to read this and just be like, what petulant children. And I don't know. There's something that creates a high level of desperation when you've been without a water. There's something that, I don't know, you get to the end of that and it's just, and you get that water, and it's the best water. It could come from a garden hose, and it's the best water you've ever had. But they go without water for some time, and they get to a place, and they're thirsty again. But this interaction is a little different. In Exodus chapter 17, starting in verse 3, but the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me. So the Lord answered Moses, go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel. Take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand before you by the rock of Oreb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So they're thirsty. They cry out to the Lord, and God once again provides for their needs. And what's happening here? What's with all the testing? Why? Why go through all of this, God? What is with the Shema? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your very. Why? Because the Christ life is about a life spent trusting in and leaning into God as the provider and as the source for everything. Not just some of our life, but all of it. You know, there's a common saying, water is life, right? So it's interesting that out of the three tests that the Israelites faced, two of them center around water. Now, I want to take a look back at Exodus 17 and pay attention to something here. It says in verse 5, "The Lord answered Moses, 'Go out in front of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel. Take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand before you at the rock of Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink.'" Now Moses is to go stand before the mountain and strike the rock. But where does it say God will stand? "I will stand before you at the rock of Horeb." So Moses is not just striking the rock, he's striking God. And out of God flows the water that quenches the thirst of the Israelite people. What does it mean to love the Lord your God with all your very? I think for us, there's a tendency for us to forget. For us to go through life and things are great. Things are good for a while. Everything's up and to the right. My business is thriving. My family is happy. My teenager smiled at me yesterday. My kid is in the gifted program. Whatever it is. When things are good, it's easy for us to forget the back then. And I think what God is saying to us here is he says, remember, surround yourself, stand next to me, stay close to me, never leave my side, because I'm your source. God, he provided for water for the Israelites in their need, in their thirst, in their dire desperation. He gave them water. For you, I'll be your provision. I'll be everything you could ever need. God, he was struck, and out of him poured water. Hundreds of years later, there came a king who was born, lived a sinless life. He was crucified, and he was struck. And scripture tells us that out of him poured blood and what? Water. Christ is the very source of everything we need. The living water that comes from him, it satisfies our souls in a way nothing else can. In a way that we could never make happen, he does that. He took the blow for your sin and mine. And our call is to simply rest in him, to lean into his goodness, whether things are good or things are bad, and maybe especially when things are good, to remember that he is the source of everything, to wake up each and every day and simply open our arms and say, "Jesus, I need you. Every hour, I need you. This moment, I need you. The next moment, I need you. Today, I need you. Tomorrow, I'll need you more. Next week, I need you. Next month, I need you. No matter what happens, I need you. No matter what happens to my kids, what happens with my kids, I need you. No matter where you take me in life, I need you because you're the only thing that can satisfy. Would you stand tonight? To close, I just want us to sing this simple song. There's not much to it, and it just simply says, Jesus, I need you. And I want us to make it a declaration tonight, arms wide, hands high, God, I need you for every bit of me, for every bit of my life. So come on, Palm Valley Church, tonight, can we sing this? Jesus, I need you. Come on.
We hope you enjoyed this message today. Don't miss out on next week's teaching. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and keep up to date with what's happening at palmvalleychurch.com.